Okay, so today we're going to be learning about Parshat B'Shalach with the insights of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. So we're going to be exploring the story of the splitting of the sea. So the first fascinating part of this shiur is where Rabbi Sacks points out that it was a setup. What do I mean by that? Our parsha begins, "Vayhi b'shalach paro et ha'am," and Pharaoh sends the nation out. "V'lo nacham aleihem derech eretz plishtim ki karovu," and God does not want to let the Jewish people go by the way of the plishtim up to the land of Israel, the coastal route. "Ki amar aleihem peni nachem ha'am b'rotam lachama b'shavu mitzrayim," because God knows that they might regret their decision. We know there was fortresses and a lot of military presence, both the Egyptians and the Philistines in that route. So it makes sense, with our modern understanding, Rabbi Sacks points out, that God did not want them to take that route. He knew them well enough to know that they would be a bunch of scaredy cats and they might never make it to the land of Israel. So that seems to be the simple explanation as to why he takes them down. If God brings them downhill, totally out of the way, if you look at the map, down the way of the Yam Suf. Let's translate it, the Red Sea. Now, if we keep going, as the Pesukim make it clear, that God had another reason why he wanted them to come down that direction. So Hashem tells them to turn back towards the Pi Hachirot, before these idols. So Rashi explains that it's really just pshat. What was Hashem doing here? Kidei lahat ot et paro. He wanted to fool Pharaoh. Shumar tohim hem baderech. It would seem like the Jews were lost, doing a 360, going the wrong direction. And perhaps it would seem like the Egyptian idols were too powerful for the Israelite God. And it would kind of urge Pharaoh into attacking those Israelites. They were coming back. Here's our shot. And in fact, that's exactly what the Pesukim say. Chizakti et lev paro. And Hashem says he strengthened Pharaoh. Radaf achareyam. And he will run after them. Yichabda b'paro v'chachalav yadu mitzrayim kini Hashem. And Hashem intended on letting Egypt know that I am God. In other words, it's clear from the Torah that Hashem wants the showdown at Yam Suf to happen. And we know it works. For the first time after witnessing the miracles of Kriyas Yam Suf, the Torah tells us, "Yar Yisrael at Yagdo Dola Asher Asa Hashem Mitzrayim," and the Israelites saw the great hand of God by Yiru Amat Hashem, by Aminu Ba Hashem Moshe Ba'ado. They feared God and they believed in Hashem and in Moshe his servant. So the magic of Yam Suf works. And of course, we know that this is a big part of our tradition. On Seder night, we talk about all the miracles that happened at Yam Suf and that it was even greater than the Makos. And there was something about that experience that somehow brought true belief into the Jewish people. But the question that Rabbi Sacks asked, and it's really a very good question, is what is so unique about that moment of Yam Suf? In other words, okay, it was a miracle. It showed God's power. He's more powerful than the Egyptians. And it was a moment of justice where the Egyptians got what they deserved and they were, you know, punished for their cruelty towards the Israelites. Fine. But I mean, didn't we already see that throughout every Makkah, God's power and God punishing them so amazingly in Makkas Bechores? What's new here? What was it about the Kriyas Yam Suf experience, which, as Chazal say, even the lowest maidservant was on the highest level of prophecy? What exactly happened that was so transformative, that was so special at Yam Suf? So, the truth is, there are many suggestions that we could give to explain what was unique about Kriyas Yamsuf. Some ideas that went through my mind is, first off, well, the Egyptians, you know, they killed the Jews by throwing their children in the water. So Midah Kenegan Midah, now they are being killed in the water. And that was what impressed, as Rashi says, Yitro. He saw it in the exact same way they tried to kill the Jews. That's how God killed them. But, I mean, you could also respond and say, well, isn't that the first plague? When the Yam Suf turned into blood, wasn't that also a way of Midah Kenegan Midah? So what was unique about Kriyas Yam Suf? Another thought I had when I was thinking about this question is, well, in this Kriyas Yam Suf, the Jewish people were experiencing real fear, right? They really were fearful that the Egyptians were going to kill them. The other plagues, they kind of stood by the sidelines. They didn't necessarily feel the same amount of fear. And then after experiencing that fear, they experienced the salvation of Hashem, the total mapecha, how their enemies got swooped into the water. I mean, that was what was unique about Kriyas Yam Suf, the almost destruction which led to the salvation. And that was just something that would stick in their DNA. And I still think that's a unique element of Kriyas Yam Suf. But Rabbi Sacks is going to stress in his own unique way a different way of looking at the Kriyas Yam Suf experience. Rabbi Sacks, first of all, points out that it's clear that the Jewish people were going to struggle with the thought, wouldn't it have been better if we would have stayed in Egypt? And we see throughout the sojourn of the Jews in the exile, in the desert, that they often look back and reminisce. Like it says in our parsha, just a few psukim later, didn't we tell you? The Jews complained to Moshe, wouldn't it be better just work in Egypt? Would it be better to go back to Egypt than to die in the desert? So clearly this was what the Jewish people were struggling with. They may not have completely been ready to leave Egypt. They may have left Egypt, but there's still a bit of that, wouldn't it have been better, FOMO. Maybe we should just go back to Egypt in their consciousness. And Hashem wants to help them truly move on, move past that, you know, Yetzer Hara, I wish we could just go back. The way to understand this story, Rabbi Sacks explains, is best exemplified through the story, actually, of Julius Caesar and a man named Cortes. So Julius Caesar ordered his army to cross a river called the Rubicon in his attempt to seize power. Now, such an act was strictly forbidden in Roman law, and he knew, and his army knew, that if they would not win this war, they would be executed. And thus, the phrase crossing the Rubicon was born, and indeed, of course, they won. In 1519, General Cortes was a Spanish commander, and he was engaged in the conquest of Mexico. And after his soldiers got off the boat, he burnt the ships that carried his men. His soldiers now had no possibility of escape. They had to either win or die, and once again, they won. So Rabbi Sacks explains that before the Israelites crossed the Red Sea, they were scared, they were fearful. You see this clearly in the Torah. But once they had crossed the sea, there was just no way back. Their boats were burnt, they crossed the Rubicon, and physically, they're on the other side of the Yam Suf, so it would have been nearly impossible to go back to Egypt, and psychologically and emotionally, after experiencing what they saw of the rest of Egypt, there was just no way that they could ever truly, realistically think that they were going to go back to their previous Egyptian life. They had reached the point of no return. And in another classic Rabbi Sacks move, like we've already seen him turn to history and use history as a way of bringing to life the Torah's messages, So what Rabbi Sacks now turns upon us in his book, I Believe, is he writes, I believe the greatest positive change in our lives comes when, having undertaken a challenge, we cross our own Red Sea and know there is no way back. There is only one way forward. Then at that moment, when we make that decision, we're not going back. God gives us the strength to fight our battles and to win. So I want to recount a few personal stories on this note. So one is about my buddy Ezri. Ezri was together with me in the army, and he was originally a bit overweight. I remember the first hike we took, I pushed Ezri. It was like a 2 kilometer nothing hike, but he was having a hard time, and I actually had the merit to push him a little bit, help him out. Ultimately, after 7 months of training, our unit was going to finally go to real service. But in order to do that, we needed to overcome a certain physical test. And, you know, you had to run around and climb some ropes. And then you had to jump over a certain wall. And it took most people a time or two. I don't know if it took me 2 times or 3 times. But eventually, you learn the maneuvers and you got over the hill. And the truth is, if you really had a hard time getting over the hill, the army wasn't really going to hold you back. They'd find a way to sneak you through. And make sure that, you know, while nobody was looking, you passed the test and your buddies, you know, hopped you over or something like that. They weren't really going to make people miss service because they need every soldier. But Ezri actually had a hard time. He was not able 1, 2, 3, 10 times. He could not jump over that wall. And eventually, like I said, they tried to just get him over, wink, wink. And he refused. He said, absolutely not. I'm going to pass this one way or the other. And I remember we were all already in our units, you know, already in service. And he was just there every day, waking up, eating breakfast and working on the wall. He had thrown his knapsack over the wall, so to speak. And eventually, I think it took 2 weeks, but eventually Ezri did jump over the wall without cheating. And eventually, indeed, Ezri became the most successful of all of the soldiers. He stayed for 5 years in the army, at least, and he became a very high commander. He had that drive, that commitment. He threw his commitment into the army full force, and there was no looking back. Another story that I read that reminds me of this theme, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin writes in his wonderful book about his biography, how he and his wife decided to move from their synagogue and their life as, you know, as shul rabbis, and basically become settlers in Efrat, which at that point was uninhabited. There was no electricity. It was freezing cold. It was the winter. And they decided to actually sell their house in New York and invest the money in a big plot of land. In Efrat, there's no going back. And indeed, ultimately, it did get extremely challenging, but they knew that there was no way back to New York, and that was ultimately which gave them the strength of moving on and being able to found what is now one of the most successful yeshuvim, Efrat. One last, you know, personal story. I remember when I was in high school, I had a big struggle because my buddies used to come over and play sports every Shabbos. And at a certain point, I realized I didn't really want to be using my Shabbos to be playing sports all Shabbos. I wanted to be learning. But it was hard because all of my friends and a lot of people who were important to me were, you know, wanting me to play. And I also loved playing, but I knew that it wasn't really my highest Torah self. And I just remember at a certain point, you know, I think it was junior year, after a bad davening where I just felt bad about myself after playing sports the whole day, I confronted one of my closest friends and I said, listen, I just can't do this anymore. I'm not playing anymore. Stop asking me. You guys can come to my house and play, but I'm going to the Beis Medrash. And, you know, I was finally able to kind of move past that struggle and move on. And, you know, I played sports on Fridays and Saturday nights, but I no longer actually struggled with it because I finally was able to make a decision and move forward. So first off, just, you know, bless you guys and give you a moment to think, Have you ever had a Kriyas Yam Suf moment, a transition moment, when you just made a commitment? You decided, that's it. I'm going for it. I'm opening up this organization. I'm joining this yeshiva. Whatever it is, making that commitment. Have you ever done it in the past? And if you haven't, or if you had, maybe there's a Kriyas Yam Suf moment right now in your life, which Hashem is deep inside our soul, beckoning us to make that commitment. And just think for a few moments about that. Okay, I have something specific in mind, but maybe one day we'll share what moments, what everyone's thinking about. All right, one last thought I'd like to offer. It's actually part two in a different article by Rabbi Sacks in his book, Covenant Conversation. And it's much, much better inside, so you should read the whole article. It's excellent. But Rabbi Sacks now explains, so what exactly changed with the Jewish people after Yam Suf? So he explains that this was a moment of transformation. We went from slaves of Egypt to slaves of Hashem. We entered a sort of brit, and a brit was kind of passing over from place A to place B. That's how the ceremony was done. We see this many times in Chumash and in Tanakh, just like by Brit Bin Matarim, the covenant also by Yeshua, the Jewish people are entering into Israel. So too, going through Kriyas Yam Suf is a moment of transformation for the Jewish people, physically and legally. And so what changes? Well, what changes is that in the beginning of our parsha, by Kriyas Yam Suf, Moshe says to the people, Al tiru yitatzvu uru et Yeshua Hashem asher yaseh lechem. Don't be scared, because God is going to do a salvation. Hashem yilachem lachem v'atem tachrishu. God is going to fight for you. You just be silent. You watch Hashem's salvation. But at the end of our parsha, we have a chiastic structure with the Kriyas Yam Suf in between. At the end of our parsha, there's another war. And in this war, Amalek comes and fights the Jews in Rephidim. And what do the Jewish people do? They don't just wait for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to do a miracle. They go out and fight, and Moshe lifts up his hands to the heavens. And when his hands are up, the Jewish people succeed. And say, and they go and they fight the Amalekites. Him and Moshe and Chur. Yidei Moshe kvedim yikhu evan yasimu tachta b'yashev aleya. Aron v'chur tamchu b'yadav mizeh v'mizeh. Echad v'yadav emuna ad bo ha-shemesh. And so Chur and Aaron hold up Moshe's hands. Yechalosh Yeshua tamalek v'tamol v'chayav. And these fearless warriors take out the Amalekites. So in the beginning of our parsha, it was all God. But by the end of the parsha, the Jewish people have transformed. They now are ready to fight their own fights. But the message is not that we just have to forget about God and fight on our own. The message is we have to fight on our own, but always knowing that it's really Hashem who's actually fighting for us. And that's, as the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah explains, the meaning of Moshe lifting up his hands to the heavens. As the Mishnah writes, "V'chi yadav Moshe v'asot nachma," was it that Moshe had supernatural power of lifting up his hands? No, El Lomar Lacha Kozman Shai Yisrael Mistaklin Klapim Allah Mashabdim Et Libam La'avim Shabashamayim. Whenever the Jewish people lifted up their heads, their hearts to God, and subjugated humbly their hearts, recognizing it's really Hashem that's fighting this war, Hayumitz Gabrim, they would succeed. If not, they would fail. In other words, yes, Hashem wants us to fight our own battles. Okay? That is the message. But He wants us to fight those battles, recognizing that really it's Hashem who's actually fighting the battles. To have that trust, that bitachon. On the other hand, we have to make our ishtadlus. We have to go out 100%. And on the other hand, to know deep inside, and Shar Bitachon talks about all the time, that ultimately Hashem is running the show and we are completely dependent on them. Hashem wants us to develop our skills, our confidence. He wants us to fight our own fight. He doesn't want to give it to us on a silver spoon. But we always have to do it with the knowledge that it's dependent on Hashem and it's a gift from Hashem. These are easy things to say. It's not so simple to live in real life, right? I'm talking to myself to do 100% efforts, but to always know that it's totally HaKadosh Baruch Hu. By the way, perhaps this is the explanation Rabbi Schwab suggests of Kashe. It's hard to make a zivug, to get a soulmate, Kekriyas Yamsuf, like the splitting of the sea. On the one hand, we have to go and jump into the water, like Nachshon Ben Aminadav. We have to do the Ishtadlis. On the other hand, we have to know that it's all HaKadosh Baruch Hu who's ultimately in charge. We have to go on the date. We have to make the efforts to get married, but we have to also know that it's ultimately Hashem who's in charge. So this is the story of our lives. Bezrat Hashem, especially in our generation, we have to do our efforts. Hashem wants us to go out there and, you know, and to pretend like it's dependent on us, but deep inside, and always in our consciousness, to know that it's all from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem should bless you. Hashem should bless me. To always have that, those two sides of the coin, and Hashem should bless us to succeed until it be us. Have a wonderful, beautiful Shabbat.